It is Monday, December the 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, President Trump's son-in-law says no decisions have been made on supporting Jerusalem as Israel's capital.
The president, I think, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have probably realized there aren't any good options that their political base can accept.
Also, there are reasons to be tense, are there, about North Korea?
The North Korean capabilities are certainly getting better, but I think that they're doing this for defensive reasons. I don't think it's increased the likelihood that they're going to try to attack us.
Tweets from the U.S. president, plus the sounds of Atlantic Star. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. President Trump has not yet decided whether to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital or whether to proceed immediately in moving the U.S. embassy from Tel Aviv to the Holy City. That's according to his son-in-law and senior advisor, Jared Kushner, who made a rare public appearance at the Brookings Institution Sabin Forum.
What I'll say is that the president's going to make his decision and he hasn't made his decision? He's still looking at a lot of different facts, and that when he makes his decision, he'll be the one to want to tell you, not me. So he'll make sure he does that at the right time.
Kushner's comments were his first public remarks on his efforts to restart peace talks between the Israelis and Palestinians. Shortly before Kushner spoke, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas warned that American recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital would jeopardize the White House Middle East peace efforts. VOA's Victor Beatty asked Randolph-Macon College Middle East scholar Michael Fischbach for his thoughts on all of this.
Well, I think it would be, as some Middle Eastern leaders have said, fairly catastrophic for the peace process. It's hard to imagine that serious talks could go on, because this is a game changer in terms of not just the current Israeli-Palestinian peace process that the U.S. has been trying to shepherd. It's a game changer as well in that it marks a drastic shift in American policy toward Jerusalem, toward Israel, toward the entire Middle East, and it sends a signal really to the United Nations. Countries have just about unanimously in the last 50 years declined to establish embassies or declare Jerusalem as the capital of Israel in respect for the UN decision to partition Palestine in 1947. So it's changing course on just about every level, and I can't see that anything good would come out of it.
What is the reason for the move?
I think the reasons, frankly, are domestic politics, domestic American politics. I think President Trump, once again, is playing to a base. He's playing to a campaign promise. He's very keen on showing people who elected him that he's carrying out his campaign promises. It's in light of the fact that the U.S. State Department has seen such an exodus of experts on just about every other part of the world, it really boggles the mind to imagine that there is someone who really understands the Middle East who is encouraging him to do this as a good thing. Democratic, Republican, all administrations, and indeed most countries of the world have said, we're not going to declare Jerusalem the capital of Israel or move embassies there pending any kind of final solution. I mean, this is truly, as I said, a game changer.
22 years ago, Congress passed a law allowing the embassy to move from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. So is this really that big a deal?
It is a big deal because since that time, it's never happened. Again, even that decision back in the 90s was really a decision based on domestic American politics. There is an international consensus in the UN, outside the UN, about certain matters relating to the Arab-Israeli conflict. The fact that certain constituencies in the United States don't agree with those ground rules that have been established by the global community for decades is interesting, but it's not something that can be done away with willy-nilly. It's a very dangerous precedent, and I would urge the president to exercise great caution in this regard.
But the Middle East peace process is, in effect, moribund today, is it not?
Yes, and I think a conspiracy theorist, which of course there are plenty in the Middle East, would say that this is done intentionally, the president, I think, and his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, have probably realized there aren't any good options that their political base can accept. Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu, is certainly no fan of the peace process, and I can imagine he would be ecstatic because the Palestinians will certainly walk away. They don't have any options anyway. At least this could they could point to this as the formal reason why they're giving up. The Arab world would reject it. On the other hand, perhaps President Trump believes that with recent moves by Saudi Arabia and Egypt, that maybe the Arab world doesn't care that much any longer. But I think that it really would set the peace process in deep, move it from moribund to deep freeze.
Jordan has begun consultations on convening an emergency meeting of this issue of the Arab League and the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Is this going to create a divide between the U.S. and the Arab world?
Under normal circumstances, it would. As I said, however, Saudi Arabia's recent diplomatic efforts in places like Yemen and Lebanon, not to mention the Syrian civil war in the last 5 years and the various allies that that's created, Saudi conflict with Qatar, has really frankly fractured the Arab world. Normally, again, as you suggested, this would have prompted really a united Arab front against U.S. efforts. But it's really difficult to determine now. Palestine traditionally, issues relating to the Palestinians have been a unifying force, at least publicly for the Arab world. But things among the Arabs are so fractured now that perhaps President Trump can do this and receive at best a muted Arab response, which would really be bad news for the Palestinians and, again, a great triumph, I think, for Israel.
Comes as the time that the Palestinians are trying to reconcile their differences.
Right, and that's one of the ironies. Again, if they did so, the onus would be on the Israelis to negotiate with a unified Palestinian body politic that includes Hamas, and they refused to do that. So moving the embassy to, or at least stating that Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, would throw the ball into the Palestinians' courts, who would then conveniently walk away from the talks and thus excuse the Israelis from having to deal with a unified Palestinian negotiating team that included Hamas. Unfortunately, no matter how this works out, really the Palestinians are the big losers.
Michael Fischbach, professor of history at Randolph-Macon College, also a prolific author, including the Encyclopedia of Palestinians. He was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. This is VOA.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
This is VOA's International Edition. Senior U.S. Republican Senator Lindsey Graham says the time has come to start moving dependents of U.S. military personnel out of South Korea. Last week, North Korea shattered months of relative quiet by firing off an intercontinental ballistic missile that some observers say showed their ability to strike the U.S. It was North Korea's most powerful weapons test yet. Graham's comments followed those by U.S. National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster, who said the chances of war with North Korea are increasing every day. We asked Pacific Forum President Ralph Kosa what his thoughts are on all of this.
Well, I think the situation is, you know, the North Korean capabilities are certainly getting better, but I think that they're doing this for defensive reasons. I don't think it's increased the likelihood that they're going to try to attack us. And I think talk of preventive war is probably aimed at making the North Koreans nervous but in truth seems to be making everyone but the North Koreans nervous while convincing the North Koreans that they need to go full speed ahead on their nuclear program.
U.S.-South Korea air exercises also underway this week in the region, and we asked Kosa if those are a provocation, as Pyongyang suggests.
North Korea says everything is provocative, but these are defensive exercises that are aimed at defending South Korea, and that's what we're both there for. So I don't consider it any more provocative than anything else. Provocation, I guess, is in the eye of the beholder.
Also, there have been reports the U.S. military is considering placing missile defense sites on the U.S. West Coast. Meantime, the U.S. state of Hawaii has resumed monthly statewide testing of Cold War-era nuclear attack warning sirens for the first time in at least a quarter century in preparation for a possible missile strike from North Korea. U.S. Army General Major General Joe Logan is in Hawaii.
Being that North Korea has threatened the territory of Guam, state of Hawaii, and the continental United States, we took it upon ourselves to be able to find a way to, one, notify the public in the event that this was ever carried out, if there was an attack to the state of Hawaii. And so one of the ways to do that is to have a siren system. But the siren system is only one of three ways. So we'll also have a script come over the television, interrupting the broadcast, and on radio that will also exemplify what we're doing here and explain what is going on.
State emergency management authorities said they decided in recent months to reactivate the state's nuclear attack sirens for the first time since the 1980s, after experts deemed some of North Korea's missiles were capable of reaching Hawaii. President Trump, in a series of Sunday morning tweets, attacked the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation and said he never asked then-director of the FBI, James Comey, to stop investigating his one-time national security advisor, Michael Flynn, about his contacts with Russia's ambassador to Washington. The tweets come 2 days after Flynn pleaded guilty in Washington to lying to FBI agents about conversations he had with former Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak in the weeks before Mr. Trump took office in January. International Edition's Lori London asked former CIA agent and current criminal defense attorney Jack Rice what the plea deal says about the ongoing investigation.
Extraordinary, because what this means is they're getting absolute cooperation from Mike Flynn, which means he's going to gut himself and give them everything that he's got and anything else that he can get. But what makes this most significant is he makes the point very clear that he didn't do this alone. His contact with the Russians wasn't a rogue operation. He was in direct contact with most of the senior staff, and so they would have known about these Russian contacts. The real question is whether or not, when those people were all interviewed by the Bureau as part of this investigation, whether they perpetuated the lie that Flynn perpetuated. And frankly, it would be consistent with what we have seen from the administration, because they continued to lie about this. And I use that word very specifically, lie about contacts with the Russians long after the question of Flynn being fired.
Is it possible that he could have acted without Trump or Kushner's knowledge?
No. In fact, the evidence that they have in this case makes it clear that, in fact, he was having contact with at least McFarland through part of it, at least Kushner through part of it, at least Manafort through part of it. These are all direct connections that can be established objectively. That proves that he was not a rogue elephant.
So what do you think Michael Flynn may have revealed to the special counsel?
I think what Michael Flynn did was this, and I've had to deal with the Bureau in the past myself when I'm sitting down with clients. You have to sit down and give a proffer, and you're sitting in a small room with a bunch of FBI agents or the U.S. attorney, and you basically have to gut yourself. What I think he really did was he established that he was having ongoing back-channel communications with the Russians, and he wasn't doing this on his own. He was closely connected with other senior members of the Trump team, so they knew what he was doing, and he may have actually been directed to have very specific conversations. That's what I think the Mueller team has right now.
The president went on quite the tweet storm, including saying that he fired Flynn for lying to the vice president and to the FBI. And I understand there's some significance to that tweet and how that tweet and his use of social media could be getting him into legal trouble himself.
It's extraordinary. From the beginning, what the president has said from the beginning was that he fired Mike Flynn for lying to the vice president about his contacts with the Russians. There's two pieces to this. The first piece is that it's clear that it wasn't just Mike Flynn's contact with the Russians. Now we know that he let a lot of the senior leadership know that the Russians were involved and that they knew about it too. So that's an interesting piece. But the more significant piece is this question that Donald Trump knew that Mike Flynn was lying to the FBI. That is dramatic, because what that means is when Mike Flynn lies to the FBI, that is a crime. Some 4 months later, when Donald Trump goes to Comey and says, I want you to drop this investigation, that's obstruction, because you're literally saying a crime has been committed, but I'd like this thing to go away. That's a crime. And this is one of the, if not smoking gun, approaches that point. And that's why the president and the president's people had to run away from this, because it's an admission by the president that he knew something and made a decision and took actions as a result of what he knew.
Do you buy the explanation that President Trump's attorney actually wrote the tweet? That's what he said.
No, I don't buy it at all. As a criminal defense attorney, I would never write tweets for anybody else, my client, ever. And as the president of the United States, I would never do that. Notice these tweets were in the first person. He said, I knew that he lied to the FBI. That wasn't his attorney saying that. That was the president. And by the way, as a criminal defense attorney, I would never put my client in a place where I would actually, me, expose him to a crime, which is exactly what that tweet does. There is no criminal defense attorney who is worth his or her salt who would do something like that, ever.
But if he did, would that absolve Trump?
I don't think it would, because I think the argument then becomes, does that mean that the president told them this, that they knew this, that they have access to this information, because that's what the lawyers were told. And by the way, the claim now is that it was the lawyers who said this and not the president. This actually potentially waives the attorney-client privilege, which means this investigation could now pivot and actually go after the lawyers to know exactly what it was that they were told by the president from somewhere in the middle of January onward. That is astounding and must be petrifying for the president. Honestly, as a criminal defense attorney, I would be petrified for my client if something like this had happened.
That's Jack Rice. He is a criminal defense attorney and former CIA agent. He spoke with my colleague, Lori London. This is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
In the very center of our Milky Way galaxy, there's a huge, supermassive black hole called Sagittarius A. Located nearby is a region of space that is rocked by strong tidal forces and immersed in powerful ultraviolet light and X-ray radiation. Astronomers figure that this environment really shouldn't be an ideal location for stars to form, especially low-mass stars like our Sun. But new observations made with the Atacama Large Millimeter Submillimeter Array reveals clues of 11 low-mass stars forming within only 3 light-years from the supermassive black hole. Scientists theorize that the existence of these young protostars suggests ideal conditions to form low-mass stars can not only be found in one of the most turbulent regions of our galaxy, but perhaps even in other similar locations throughout the universe. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Now time for a little something from the world of music.
Oh,
Atlantic Star is an American band that began in the city of Greenberg, New York, with trumpeter Duke Jones, drummer Porter Carroll Jr., bassist Clifford Archer, percussionist Joseph Phillips, guitarist Sheldon Tucker, and three brothers, David, Wayne, and Jonathan Lewis, all on vocals, along with lead singer Sharon Bryant. In the late 1970s and early 1980s, Atlantic Star scored several hits on the R&B charts, including Circles and one of their favorite songs, Silver Shadows. Star lost and gained many members over time, and when the band had pared itself down to a quintet, there were more big hits, including what's considered their most popular song, Always. It's a love ballad off their album, All in the Name of Love. Star is still out on the road every year with lots of sold-out concerts. The R&B, soul, and boogie band currently consist of original band members Wayne Lewis and Jonathan Lewis, along with LaJohn Epps and Melissa Pierce. Always is always on their playlist. Let's go make a always thankful to have you with us here on the Voice of America International Edition. The latest world news is coming up shortly. Hope you'll stay tuned. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Daryl Smith, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a super Monday. Now some more from Atlantic Star.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Through its binational commission with Nigeria, the U.S. hopes to find new areas of collaboration with regard to security cooperation, economic growth and development, and democracy and governance. In the northwest region of Nigeria, Boko Haram and ISIS West Africa have wrought a great deal of destruction on the Nigerian people, forcing more than 2 million to flee from their homes. Speaking in Nigeria, Deputy Secretary of State John Sullivan said, "I want to emphasize that the United States is Nigeria's partner in this fight. We are committed to helping the Nigerian people provide their own security." The U.S. has helped Nigeria modernize its military, but a military response alone in the Northeast cannot lead to sustained peace, said Deputy Secretary Sullivan. Nigeria's success requires improvements to the economy and governance off the battlefield, including credible investigations of human rights violations and mechanisms to hold those guilty accountable for their actions. To help those affected by Boko Haram rebuild their lives, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced that the U.S. Agency for International Development will contribute an additional $45.5 million. The United States will continue to support food security and nutrition programs in Nigeria, including development programs focused on the northeastern states. Predictable economic policies and a transparent justice system are necessary to create an environment for growth and to attract businesses and investment to Nigeria. Sufficient energy resources are critical to fueling growth in Nigeria. Through the U.S. government's Power Africa initiative, the U.S. will help the Nigerian government serve the majority of Nigerians who currently lack access to electricity. In particular, Deputy Secretary Sullivan announced a $1.3 million project to address the shortage of gas available for gas-fired power plants under the Power Africa initiative. Finally, in addition to supporting the security and economic growth of Nigeria, the United States recognizes that good governance is necessary to sustain both over the long term. Fighting corruption and ensuring free and fair elections will make the government of Nigeria more accountable to its people and better equipped to secure its citizens and keep its economy growing. The United States looks forward to working with Nigeria to reach their shared security, development, and governance goals.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.